Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with Andrea Loya, Executive Director of Casa de la Paz in Denver, Colorado. Casa de la Paz, which translates as the House of Peace, was established 14 years ago to assist immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers who've just been released from the Aurora Detention Center in Aurora, Colorado. CASA, as the neighborhood refers to it, is a house that serves as a welcome center for people who have just been freed from the detention center. It is truly a peaceful place where people can come and catch their breath and begin their recovery from the trauma of mass detention. Andrea and her staff, along with dedicated volunteers, provide the tangible food, fresh clothing, access to computers, transportation, and help with contacting loved ones, as well as the intangible, the kindness and compassion, friendship, love, and understanding. When Colorado Senator Michael Bennett visited CASA, he was so impressed he invited Andrea to be his guest at the State of the Union address in Washington, D.C. in February of 2026. Bennett said, "I wanted Andrea Loya to be able to come here to demonstrate the way in which an ordinary citizen in Colorado can make a difference at a very difficult time." Andrea and I started our conversation by talking about her journey to the United States as a little girl.
My family immigrated a couple times throughout my childhood. I was three the first time that my family immigrated here. Mm. My parents worked for the postal service in Mexico, and they were able to get tourist visas. They never really wanted to stay in the U.S. and build a life here. First, it was my dad that came, and he was like, I'll work for a couple months and then I'll go back. And things were so different back then.
How many years ago was that?
That was in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And so
when the border was still fluid and you could move back and forth.
Well, my dad still has a Colorado license from that year, and he had a tourist visa.
Yeah.
So the times are so different. He worked for I think a couple months, and then he was like, my mom, I guess, could also come and work for a little bit. Again, the border's so fluid. So we came, we met him. I think we were here in the U.S. In Colorado for about 6 months. And then my grandfather got sick. So we went back and my dad stayed over for a little bit and worked here. But that separation of being like without your loved ones was a lot, even just in a working place. So he went back to Mexico, and he always had a dream of like building a business there, honestly, he just wanted to build a life there. He had what we call pollería, so like a business of selling chicken. He had a gift shop, he had a pharmacy, and it's hard. There's a lot of things that don't necessarily work out for people that way. And so I think he found himself like time and time again, it just like wasn't doing what he wanted it to do for his family. So they did that like journey again. In 2001, same reasons. It's also like being hard. It's hard to be, I think, also away from your family in general. Like we were together for a little bit, but my parents' families are all in Mexico. And so there was also that drive back to like go back and try to go back and build a life there again. And then it wasn't until actually July 4th of 2005 that we made that last journey.
How old were you then?
I was 9. I think at that point I had already like moved back and forth a little bit. So I think that last time it was so hard because I was like, I have friends now. I have an idea of like a life. My cousins were all in Mexico. And so I remember that being like a challenge. And then I had picked up English from like the first two times that I was already here, but it was imperfect. And so like learning English as a second language again, school system being so different. So it's just all these things. And I just remember like for a long time being like, this is not fun at all.
Well, yeah, as a kid, you need stability, and moving back and forth from one country to the others, I'm sure it was traumatizing for you.
Yeah, I think at the time, it was just kind of like, you're living life. But now I'm like, okay, you guys are really kind of going on and moving us, which, you know, I think in the sense of wanting opportunity for your children, that's all you really can.
Right. That you were they were trying to do the right thing. But from the eyes of a little girl, it's like, well, give me some stability here.
Yeah, for sure. And so...
It brings it up for you. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm the oldest of two, and my brother was born in the U.S. And I think one of the things that really came up talking about this a little bit earlier in the week about like growing up and stuff. And
you and your brother were talking?
No, I was talking about it with my husband, and I was talking about it with like my coworkers. And it's so interesting because we were growing up, and I'm 6 years older than my brother, but he's a citizen. And so we grew up very much, like I grew up with this understanding that even though my possibilities were better than the possibilities that I was brought up from, they were still not going to be like, there were still limitations to those possibilities,
right,
because of my status, like in the difference between my brother and I growing up in status, because we entered the border legally, as you call it, but we overstayed our visas. And so after your permit, well, really you break it once you start working and all of the other stuff, but your permit really expires kind of the 6 months after you overstay. And at that point, you know, our status was very clearly undocumented. And so growing up, it was like, do you even get healthcare because you don't have documentation? And so my brother could afford to get hurt because he was going to be able to go to the ER versus like, you better suck it up, girlfriend, because this bill is not going to give.
That must have been really hard to, I mean, there's differences between siblings, but to have that one be, what is it that makes you special and not me?
Yeah, and I think it was very much like, this piece of paper truly makes a difference in people's life. I think the healthcare one was the biggest one, but I mean, growing up, then it became like college. Like at the time, there was still no DACA when I was coming up with college. So it was like, well, what are you going to do? Because your possibilities of education are going to be very limited. It was like, but if you had a social, like, then you could. And so it was very much always like, well, do you have documentation? Anyone else in your family have documentation? But it was always like the smallest one in the family. So like when there's no pathway there.
Yeah. So did that influence what you're doing today, do you think?
Yeah, I think for sure. I grew up on Colfax and Moline. So I grew up in Aurora, right, on Colfax. And we lived on Colfax in Jamaica when we first arrived. So we never moved out of like that area, essentially. Schooling at that point, my parents were not just trying to move you around. So we stayed in the Aurora area growing up. And it wasn't until I was 16 that I realized there was a detention center. And I actually didn't even realize there was a detention center for any like advocacy or crazy reasons. My high school friends and I, we were looking for a volleyball league to play at. And at the time, Casa was using some volleyball league funds to fund itself because we were so tiny. We were at a one-bedroom apartment.
So the organization had just gotten started?
It had just gotten started. It had, like, I think it was a year when I started knowing about Casa. But the league itself, like, didn't have a huge connection to it. It was just kind of like, you were just told, like, come play, and then... At the end of that night, like that season, so it was 6 weeks, we meet a guy in a wheelchair. He had gotten released from detention, and he had met Casa at his release. But the thing about it was, like, at this point, I was just like, what is happening? Like, what is detention? What do you mean you were in there because you're an immigrant? Like, I'm an immigrant. I live, like, 5 minutes, 10 minutes from the detention center. Like, I just couldn't grasp the idea of how close I'd lived to it, how close my entire whole like situation and my growing up life had been. And then I didn't understand that this was a detention center.
Or that it was a thing.
And that it was
people were
thing.
Doing that to other people.
Yes. Not only like could I not grasp my head around the concept of immigrant detention, but then Jose was in a wheelchair because of something that happened to him in detention. Some sort of medical condition. He was a walking person when he entered that facility. And then he no longer was when they... They basically were like, well, now you're medical liability. So now they gave him freedom. And I... Yeah, so at that time, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. So I was like, oh, well, like, how can I help? I was doing, like, translations, interpretations, random things. I got involved even doing, like, a couple of simultaneous interpretation at, like, Lutheran Family Services for people getting their, like, visas and their, like, paperwork. I even got, like, a one-month job at the front desk at JAMLAC, the Justice and Mercy Legal Aid Clinic.
Where did that come from? Did that come from being... The other, the person who...
You know, I think I very quickly realized that we were just in systems that were really not for us. So I wanted to be a doctor. So I still was doing a lot of healthcare stuff. I still was trying to do my like undergrad at that time. There were so many things that lined up for me at that time. We started doing they passed the ASAP program. So I was able to do dual enrollment. As I was finishing high school and starting my classes at CCA without having to have status and without having to pay, which was huge for me. I mean, that really was starting to open the doors that I thought were going to be shut for me because of my status. My parents were talking about sending me back to Mexico so I could actually do like college. Those were the things that were really coming up at that time. So these things lining up for me here really started opening other things and like really allowed me to see different things and to experience different things and to go different routes.
What were those things that you saw that changed your direction?
My first real adult job was making appointments for people at Stride Healthcare. I worked for billing for a minute and you saw people getting stuck with bills that they didn't understand. Bills for people and their family member who had already died and they're now stuck with this bill. Things that are not explained to them in their language, people who are dismissive of them because they're not speaking English, the way that everyone expects you to already understand things when no one understands the things.
Exactly.
Healthcare
is a mystery for all of us, but.
Yes. And then I started working with a lot of undocumented people just in the nature of the work. I think it draws people a lot when you speak Spanish and you're able to help them. Yeah. It's just like, I had so many people come to me and like I worked at the NICU at St. Joe's. As a family
NICU patient advocate. New babies.
Yeah, the new babies, prenatal. So they were born before their 40 weeks. I was a financial counselor there. So I was actually helping people like figure out how they were going to pay for that, which is such a hard conversation. But you start getting into just seeing how many people are affected by the same thing and who can thrive in it and who can't. I think at that point I was just seeing it everywhere. I was seeing it at work. I was volunteering at CASA at that point already. CASA was for me a big shift. I realized very quickly I didn't want to do pre-med. Once I really got into like some of the other stuff ahead in biology, and I was like, I actually don't think this is going to be for me. At that time, I didn't want to do anything people related. So it's so funny that this is what I do now. But I was like, okay, so how can I actually be helpful to like this space?
To CASA.
Yeah, to CASA. So I actually, part of the reason I took my undergrad in nonprofit studies was for CASA, which I don't think I've ever really told anyone that, but besides my husband.
You knew that you had to know something about business.
Yeah. I knew I had to know something about business and I had to know something about management of nonprofit. And like, it just, and I wanted to contribute. Right before I was the got ED of CASA, I was working for Children's Hospital. Again, I worked in a lot of places.
So, which was for the benefit of you and the people that you're trying to help. You were a trail guide.
All of those experiences, even though they were not directly immigration experiences, even though they were not directly like ED experiences, I was learning so much about nonprofit. I was learning so much about leading in general, barriers of people, like who's really coming to you and what do they really want? I started volunteering for CASA in 2013. So CASA was founded in 2012. I loved driving people to the airport. That was one of my favorite things to do. I loved making meals for people. I don't cook for anyone now in my life actively, so don't tell them that. I used to love like coming here and helping them make their arrangements. You learn so much from people. You learn so much about things when you talk to them. And it was so fulfilling to be able to like just see how people, how much people enjoyed life and like saw life.
Wow. Even though they were in the hardest of times.
Yeah. I think honestly, that makes me so emotional because one of the very first times that I understood, other than meeting Jose, that I really understood detention was there was an exhibit at Museo de las Americas. And there were letters all over the wall about people's experiences and people who had written about their experiences in detention. And one of the letters talked about how this lady was incarcerated and she missed the sun. Like, that is the one thing that she missed so much. Like, after reading that letter, just how evident it was that people, like, that they enjoyed, like, the basic things of life. Yeah.
The things that really matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you come here and you see people and, you know, we often complain about the snow, right? Or we complain. We'll find anything to complain about. I know I do sometimes. And it doesn't matter. Rain, snow, sun, out. People are out. People go out to the back and they touch snow. They soak up all of that. And I just, not only how much do we take for granted all the time, but also how much they don't deserve to go through that and how much they don't deserve to be in a place like that and how many of them at the time. So going back before 2019, most of the folks that we saw had been folks who sought asylum at the border and were serving anywhere from a year to 2 to 3 years in detention, so, like fighting their asylum cases and fighting their cases. So we saw a lot of people who they came to the U.S. with the biggest, brightest eyes about their American dream. And then that dream was very crushed by their detention. And then you see them come out and they're like, I'm free. Like, I'm fine.
I'm a bird.
Yeah.
And I'm going to fly.
And so that is, to me, that's crazy. That's such a crazy thing to live through.
And doing this for the years that I have and interviewing some of the best people I've ever met, the question I always ask myself is why wouldn't we want those people here?
That question still remains, and I feel like it's also turned into another thing because right now a lot of the people over the last 15 months now, we've seen a lot of people who are locals. So a lot of people are from Colorado. That's very different. And it is heartbreaking because it's always heartbreaking. It's always been heartbreaking. But it's a new sense of like a crush of American dream because these people have been here for years. I mean, some of them have been here longer than I've been alive. And I think that's just ironic. You know, they don't belong here, quote unquote. And then many of them, most of them, if not all of them, just don't even have like as much of a speeding ticket or like a traffic ticket because it just, they've avoided, they have lived in the United States. They have paid their taxes. They have worked. They have contributed. They now have children. And they made all of that without ever even getting into petty trouble.
What was it like for you to accompany Senator Bennett to the State of the Union address where you were confronted with everything that you have worked to change?
That was being in the room of people who are applauding the trauma that they're causing every single day on people I meet daily is, it was, I, I don't have words to describe the feelings that go through your body for
it
that.
It must have felt like a bad dream in a way. Like, is this really happening? Is this?
I think it was a big eye opener of the things that we have that we're facing. I think it's a real eye opener of the cards that are held, who's holding the cards, and why they hold certain cards. It made me, being there in that room made me realize how important this work is. It made me realize that a lot of people are in places because of their connections, their money, their backstory, and that has allowed for them to get into some big title role. And so for me, it was just like, wow, here's all these people who want to rub their hands and uplift their titles, and the work that actually happens here is life-changing,
yeah,
is important.
People who won't just want to see the sun,
yeah,
and feel the snow,
and, yeah, and so
be that, a little bit free, you know.
Yeah, and so that for me, it was that I feel like I had my eye-opening experience of being like, huh, this is what's important in life. Witnessing that gives you a different sort of fuel and a different sort of understanding. Yeah.
So what does fuel you? How do you take care of yourself and recharge?
I play volleyball. So I still do play volleyball. I don't play at the same league anymore. But I play volleyball. I play co-ed. I play women's. It's fun. I just get to hit the ball and I get to deal with something other than like the life.
Tactile stuff.
My daughter is, I think, one of the things that really is like, you need to take time off, lady, because I'm right here. So I think that balance, she has really taught me that balance of being like, yeah, your stuff is important, but I'm important too.
Well, and it probably takes you back to being the little girl that was in the middle of a lot of chaos, and you're going, I can't do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and my daughter, I think my daughter understands attention, immigrant detention.
Wow. She's 4 years old.
Yeah. She goes to, she calls protest La Lucha. So she likes going to La Lucha. And she likes to carry her little signs into little protest. And,
all right.
But I think at the same time, kids have a way of teaching you that if your cup isn't full, that is not going to be good. So I feel like for sure, like parenting is hard. So I think for other parents who might be like, that is not self-care. I agree. I think it's definitely like, I think parenting can be really hard, but I think on the opposite end, she's such a reminder of slowing down and of like prioritizing things, or like how, what's important.
Well, I bet that young woman that you were back then would look at you and have a thing or two to say. What do you think she'd say to you now?
I hope she would just tell me that I didn't have to have so much doubt all the time. I would hope that she's like, don't have that much doubt. Like, you use your brain enough. You got this. And I think she would also laugh at the fact that I would always say that I hated people. I was so mad at different things with all the right reasons, right, honestly.
Well, you were a teenager when you realized, wait, they're locking immigrants up just down the street?
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time,
that'd make you sassy.
Yeah, I was something. I think most people would still say I'm something. But I, you
gotta be something. If you don't have sass, then doing what you're doing.
So, and then I think she'd definitely tell me to just keep standing. Like, you're fine. You're fine.
I think she'd say that she wanted to be like you when she grew up. Thanks for everything you do to make this place a peaceful place for people to come and find shelter, to actually find shelter and love and affection after the experience they've had at the hands of those other folks.
Yeah, we are very humbled to be a part of their journey. And I think this place is truly like peace in the midst of chaos.
That was Andrea Loya, executive director of Casa de Paz, the House of Peace. Since it was established in 2012, Casa has helped 4,300 immigrants from 80 countries begin their recovery from the trauma they have suffered at the Aurora Detention Center. If you'd like to help provide peace in the midst of the chaos, Casa welcomes you. To donate or to find out more about how you can join the effort, go to Casa de Paz, Colorado. That's CASADEPAZ, Colorado.org. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories Program. To listen to other stories, please go to immigrantstories.net or to kdnk.org. You can also find us on Facebook or on Apple Podcasts. A special thanks to Andrea Loya and her staff and volunteers who have dedicated themselves to restoring the faith and the hope and the dreams of those who fled here looking for what Ronald Reagan referred to as the shining city on the hill in his farewell address. Reagan described a city teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace, a city where the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. Thanks for listening.